Okay, I was just over there thinking how much fun it must be to sing with musicians like this. And how fun it must be to be musicians like this who have the opportunity to play for such fabulous voices that this church has. It is mind-blowing. I'm so grateful. When I was here at the beginning of last month, my talk title was, it just left me. My talk title was, As You Love Yourself. I did talk about sweethearts, but it was As You Love Yourself. And I talked about the idea, and I won't go into it deeply, but I talked about the idea that there is a scripture which comes from the words of Yeshua, the words of Jesus, where he says, you may get confused sometime because there are so many laws and there are so many prophets telling you different things about how to attain the kingdom, queendom, moredom, alldom of God, which is the experience of peace and joy and love that all human beings seek after because it is actually home. Jesus says you don't need to get confused by all of the messages from all of the messengers if you just follow this one rule. He said that this law is above every prophet that has ever come down the pike, and it is above every message that you have ever heard, regardless of how simple or complicated those messages may have impacted you at whatever level. He says that the law is, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, and all of your strength. And you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. And I talked last time I was here, and I actually spoke about it a bit in Boston last week, that what got lost for me and what I think gets lost for a lot of people is that final part of the statement that I have preached so many times to people about love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all of your strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. The as you love yourself was almost an afterthought, and it came almost in a whisper. And I think that that's what I've observed with a number of messengers in countless messages that I have delivered personally and that I have heard other people deliver, that there was almost an overriding that final part, that final character in this message. Talks about love God with everything, with your everything, and love them, whoever they are, with your everything. And then getting lost in it as you love yourself. I have observed in my own life and in the lives of many, many people that there is a capacity to get confused about whether it is right or wrong to love ourselves, to really love me. And as much as I love you, I have come to the conclusion that if I don't love me, it is really impossible for me to love others. And I think that that's true for everyone. I think that if we are around trying to love other people all of the time without loving ourselves, we're always aware that there is an empty space inside of us that only we can fill. Even if we are loved deeply by a significant other, that love that they feel for us is all for naught. In fact, it can make things worse if I don't love me. I can wonder, how are they duped? What are they missing that they can adore me who do not adore myself? They can love me when I don't love myself. So if I don't love me, I will always go around seeking to receive love from an outside source, from an outside person. And I said that one of the things I wanted us to drop was this idea of introducing our significant other as my better half. You know, because what we get with a better half, we are a half looking for another half so that we can become whole. And this is never going to work for us, because if we think that the only way I am whole as a half a person is to have a better half along with me, we will miss the point of the idea, the truth, the fact that it is my job to fill this void within me. If I have a significant other who I think of as my better half, or I think of as the one who fulfills me, makes me happy, puts my heart to fluttering, and makes me feel alive and makes me love life because I have this person, what I will end up doing is sabotaging the relationship on many, many levels because I will expect that person to be my everything, and there is no one outside me who can be my everything. As hard as they might try, they cannot do it. It's a burden that we put on people. We start identifying our significant other or the love of our life as being the one who needs to make us happy, who needs to learn what it is that works for me to keep me at peace, and then do that. Sometimes we're asking God for a significant other, and I've said this years ago, sometimes if we tell the truth about it, when we say, give me a significant other, O Lord, or give me my life partner, what we're really asking for is, could you please bring me a puppet? Could you bring me a puppet, someone whose strings I can pull, who will dance a certain way and move a certain way, make certain gestures, and speak certain words that can keep me feeling okay? And that every time I find a person that fails at being able to do that, because every single person must fail, no one outside me can do that. And what it does is it stops me from taking the time and the opportunity and the energy that is required to come to a place of self-love. After the service, the last time I was here in the afternoon workshop that I did, I asked a question that I've asked many times at workshops. And the question is, do you love you? If you weren't you, would you contemplate being your significant other? If you weren't you, would you want to live with you? Would you want to walk the earth walk with you? Would you want you as a conversation person? Would you want you to depend upon? If you weren't you, would you adore you? Would you, and most people say, oh, God, that's a tough one. And to the question, do you love yourself, what I generally get over the years wherever I am is that people will answer that question generally like this. Some will just simply say, no, I don't love myself. I can tell you that right off the bat. I don't love me. But other people will say, the majority of people will say, I love me when I'm doing the right thing. I love me when I stay on my diet and stick to it. I love me when I keep all of the commitments that I've made. I love me when I'm not going off on anybody, when I'm able to hold my tongue, and when I'm doing the right thing, I love me. But like the song that was so beautifully delivered to us, it's like, when do you really need love? Is it when you're doing the right thing and sticking to your diet and you're handling your money and budgeting and paying your bills and trying to be cheerful everywhere you go? Or can you love yourself when you're dysfunctioning as well? Can you love yourself when you're falling short of your own expectations? Can you love yourself when you're a handful? Because everybody at points in their lives are a handful. And most people say, well, I can't really love myself when I am dysfunctioning, but I love myself when I am at high function. To which I reply, that is not love. I don't know what it is. It's something we've been duped into believing is love. But love is constant. Love is consistent. And love does not is not set up as a requirement that you do this or you do that and you get your act together and then I'll love you. And I give the example of a little puppy that we have. It's a little tiny dog that I got for my sister soon before she died. I think I got this dog maybe 4 weeks before my sister died, and I bought it for her. I didn't buy him for me because I was not a little dog person, like, at all. I thought something was pretty quirky about people who had little dogs. But I knew that my sister could probably only handle a little dog, so I got her this little dog. And then, as I said, she took her last breath, and I got stuck with this little dog. I had named the dog for her, and I had named the dog Keeper, because I thought that I saw a documentary where a man had a sister who had struggled with depression most of her life, and he just got her a little puppy, and he just laid it on her. And later, she got better because she said, although I could not motivate myself to get out of bed, that little puppy could make me get up to take him out to pee. He could make me get up to fill his water bowl or to give him his food. So that was my bright idea, because my sister did suffer with depression. And I thought, I'm going to buy that girl a puppy, and I'm not going to tell her anything about it, and I'm just going to lay it on her and let it heal her. At any rate, we ended up, I named the dog Keeper because I didn't want her to get rid of the dog once the dog became a handful. I wanted her to go, oh my God, Carlos gave me this dog without me even asking for a dog or wanting a dog, and then he named the dog Keeper so I can't give it away, and now I'm stuck with this dog. Well, now me and my family are stuck with Keeper. And let me tell you one thing about Keeper. Keeper is a mix. Sometimes Keeper is wagging around, eating his food, pooping and peeing on his pads, not going into the trash, just being the cutest little thing he can be. At other times when I walk downstairs in the morning, that boy has gotten into the trash somehow, and he has ripped that bag open, and there is trash like all over the kitchen. And instead of pooping right on his pad, he poops right next to his pad. Like it was just too much of an effort to make that two-step walk right there and pee on his pad. And I came down a few times, he was on the dining room table. How did he get on the dining room table? I have no clue. But he's on there where my food is, and I don't want to eat after a dog, no matter how cute he is. But let me tell you one thing, no matter what Keeper does, and no matter how Keeper misbehaves, every time I gaze at Keeper, a smile in my heart comes so big and so wide, and sometimes tears just spontaneously spring to my eyes. Tears of a heart chakra open so wide because I love that rascal no matter what. And sometimes I especially love him when he does something outrageous. Sometimes the pad is there and he poops next to the pad but not on the pad. And then you walk into the living room and he has pooped in front of the door of the woman who rents the room to the side so that she can step in it when she comes out of her room. And then I go to the front door, and he's put a third pile in front of the front door for everybody. And when he does something like that, I can't get mad. I can't get mad. I just smile, and then he wags his tail and wags his little body. It's only about that high and about that long. And he comes over to me and begs me to pick him up, like, ain't I a good boy? Ain't I great? And I pick him up, and my heart chakras open so wide. I just love him. And so in Boston last week, my sermon title was, You're a Keeper. Because there's so many times we throw our love for ourselves out the window when we poop next to the pad and not on it. When we fall short of the mark. We know, or I first found out through Eric Butterworth's book, Discover the Power Within You, like 40 years ago or whenever that book first came out, that the word sin comes from a Greek archery term. It simply means miss the mark. It means that you didn't hit the bullseye. And if you don't hit the bullseye every time you pull back your bow and let that arrow go, it is not a reason to condemn yourself and say, what a jerk I am, and I'm screwed up. When am I going to get my act together? It's just an opportunity to practice more hitting the bullseye. Sometimes your arrow might fall short. Sometimes it might fall long. Sometimes to the left or to the right. But it's an opportunity to go, I'm just going to keep on practicing so that I get to a point where I almost always hit the bullseye, and then to a point where I invariably hit the bullseye, so that when I do that and miss the mark, sin. I don't go, oh, sin, I'm a sinner. Oh, I missed the mark. Everyone misses the mark. And God is never, ever going to throw any of us away. And God is never going to be stern with us or think that we are somehow outside of the worthiness of all of God's love. I think that if I, a human being with all of my faults, with all of my misprogramming, with all of my own crap going on, with all of the stuff that I'm working through, if I can unconditionally love Keeper, who I named, then I can also practice knowing that God named me Keeper, too. And that no matter what I do, no matter how many times I miss the mark, no matter what level of dysfunctions I might pass through, that God is never doing anything but smiling upon me. And as the scripture says, saying, "This is my beloved child in whom I am well pleased. I am well pleased with Keeper because of who he is and not because of what he does." I would like all of us to get to a place where we are able to love ourselves because of who we are rather than because of what we do. To love ourselves when we're a mess, when we're a hot mess, to just love ourselves. I gave an assignment to the group of people. This is how I came to love myself. I was born loving myself. I remember it vividly. I remember the first years of my life vividly when I could not get enough of Carly. I would catch my reflection in a piece of glass or in a puddle, and I would just look down and go, "I like you. You're awesome." And then I can remember that after I was molested, the molestation started at 7 years old. I remember that I was informed by a number of my molesters that I am molesting you because there's something about you that's making me do this. There is something about you. So I lost sight of my love for me. In fact, I hated my perpetrators, but secretly I hated me more because I thought that if they're telling the truth, they would never perpetrate if there wasn't something about me that caused them to do that. So I had a road to discovering my love for myself again, getting that pre-7-year-old love that Carlos had for himself back to himself so that I could own it, so that I could own myself completely. And I did it through effort. I did it through stick-to-itiveness. I did it through not giving up. I did it through catching my mind every time a thought of self-condemnation was coming through my mind, catching myself and stopping it, and then doing an affirmation to take its place. I constantly reminded myself that it didn't matter that I was surrounded in a whole family of people who loved me and relatives who loved me and all the people at church who loved me, all the people at school who loved me, all of the people in the neighborhood who loved me. If I don't love me, sometimes other people loving me makes me not love me even more. So I knew I had to get it back. I had to learn how to fall in love with Carlos again. One of the exercises I did, and I'm sure I've shared it at Unity over the many years that I've been coming here, was I did an exercise which comes out of the Cherokee. The Cherokee tradition has many exercises that you do in the mirror. And one of the exercises that I did in the mirror was that I began to kiss myself in the mirror. And I would leave my big lip prints all over the mirror. When people came over, they'd go, "Whose big lip prints are all over all of your mirrors?" And I would go, "Those are mine. You kiss the mirror? You are quirky, dude." And I would go, "I'm falling in love with that dude in the mirror. I'm falling in love with that cat in the mirror." Michael Jackson, one of his songs was like, "I'm talking to the man in the mirror." So I would look in that mirror and look into my own eyes, and I would say, "I'm not giving up until I am completely in love with you." To thine own self be true means that you will first of all find out what is your own self. My own self is not the self I made up for quite a while, the self that said that I am separate from God, that I'm separate from love, that I am separate from my good, that I am somehow separate from my own innocence, from my own guiltlessness. It isn't about that. My true self is the self that God created me to be. As Lewis said earlier, we've come here to deepen our understanding and our conscious connection with who we are and whose we are. So when I looked at myself as not a keeper, and how do I even remember that I didn't think of myself as a keeper? It's because there were many, many times when I thought of ending my own life. I would go from ending their life to ending my life. That's not a keeper. You would not end the life of a keeper. A keeper, all you would do was, no matter what that keeper did, was that you would pick that keeper up and hold that keeper and say, "You little rascal, I love you with every breath in me." And so that mirror exercise, I gave us an assignment to the people at Unity in the City in Boston last week. And afterwards, there were a lot of them going, "I am so excited to get home to my mirror." And there were a few women who came up to me and said, I didn't have to wait to get home. And they took out their purse and they had this little mirror with their powder or their lipstick or their eyeliner. And I saw a big print of lip kiss on that mirror. It's like, I'm going to learn to love myself. Loving yourself is the most important thing you can do. Even though we are not the self we make up, it is important to embrace fully that made-up self. Even if it is a false identity, it is important for us to embrace it fully in order to move beyond it to get to who we really are. We cannot override who we think we are in order to get to who we really are. We have to get, my tendency is to think of myself as a loser. My tendency is to think of myself as being cut off from innocence. My tendency is to think of myself as somebody that is simply dysfunctional. My tendency is to think of myself as a lonely and afraid person. We have to embrace that person with who we really are in order to move into the experience of who we really are. We can't override it. Many people think they can. I've never seen one succeed, ever. And I know that it was impossible for me to succeed without embracing Carlos with all of his so-called dysfunctions and shortcomings and missing the mark. I had to remember that it's simply about practicing more and more and more. In the Bible, there is a story that takes place in the Valley of Elah, and it is a story about a little kid whose mom made biscuits and porridge and told him to take these to your brothers because they are fighting a big battle against the enemies of our nation. I want you to take these biscuits and porridge to your older brothers because they are fighting a tough army. And the kid gets there with the biscuits and he noticed that his brothers and the others are not fighting. They're cowering. They are afraid. They are hiding under bushes and behind rocks and behind boulders. And when he asked, why aren't you fighting? They said, well, the other army, the Philistine army, has a giant. His name is Goliath. He is nobody to mess with. You can't win against that kind of a giant. It would be like us saying, you can't win against a cancer diagnosis. You can't win against a diagnosis with AIDS. You can't win against the political system that is in place right now that is set up not to let anybody in but to keep everybody out. You can't win against a racist society or a homophobic society or a sexist society or an ageist society. You just can't win. That's, everybody's got their own Goliath out there. And if you are cowering behind a bush or a tree or a rock, then you are being like this little boy whose name was David's brothers and the rest of the army. Well, David did not have a sense of himself as being a regular soldier who might die in a war. All he knew was that he was a shepherd, and he knew that as he kept his father's sheep, the Heavenly Father kept him. He knew that he was a keeper as far as God was concerned. And so he went to the king and he said, if everybody else is too chicken to go fight Goliath, I'll go up against Goliath myself. And the king, of course, laughed and everybody else that was around laughed. Oh, this kid, kids think they can do anything. Kids think everything is possible. Now he's going to go up against Goliath. Well, finally, he convinced the king to let him at least give it a try. And the first thing the king said to him was, David, if you're going to go out there against Goliath, I'm going to give you my sword, I'm going to give you my shield, and I'm going to give you my armor. And so he started strapping David up with his armor and his shield. And David felt like an alien in this stuff. He had never been in this stuff. And he said to the king, to Saul, he said, I can't go fight him in this stuff. This is not me. This is not my authentic self. This is not the way I go up against any threat in my world. In my world, I have a little sling, and I grab some rocks. I have taken down a bear. I have taken down a lion. I don't see why it should be any problem for me to take down a giant. A giant can't be any more ferocious than a lion or a bear. I've already done those things. If you bring to mind the things you've already done, that you have already accomplished, Bring to mind the times where you have already made it by putting one foot in front of another foot in front of another foot through the valley of the shadow of death. If you bring to mind the successes that you have in bringing down the enemy, in returning to sanity, in returning to peace in your heart and peace in your mind, in returning to the childlikeness of thinking all things are possible. If you have, you, and I don't know who you are and I don't care what the details of your story are, but I want to tell you one thing I do know about you. You have taken down a lion and you have taken down a bear. And you did it your way. You didn't do it in the king's armor. So he shucked himself out of the king's armor. That was not being true to his own self. And he went down to the creek with nothing but a slingshot, and he picked out five smooth stones. You can think of the five smooth stones as the unity principles. Why do they call them smooth stones? The difference between a smooth stone and a rough-edged stone is that a smooth stone has been worked. A rough-edged stone has not. This unity stuff, these principles, these teachings, they work if you work them. He didn't pick up jagged stones that had never been handled, that had never been worked. He picked up smooth stones that the creek and the water rushing and the rapids had tumbled them and moved them against other stones until they became smooth. The unity principles must be worked in order to work. They can't just be something we plug into on a Sunday when we come to this sanctuary. They must be worked every day. They must live in our minds and in our hearts so that we are constantly working them so that they become smooth. And we can find out what David found out when he went up against Goliath with five smooth stones. He didn't even have to use four of them. One unity principle, if worked correctly, if used, if handled, if made smooth, if you own that one principle, can get you out of hell and into heaven in the twinkling of an eye. One principle. If you know one, if you believe in that one, if you trust in that one, you can go up, get up against whatever the giant is in your life. Giant in your life might look like the appearance of lack and limitation in your home, in your company, in your church, in your family. It might look like a financial issue. It might look like an appearance of dis-ease issue. And what you want is to be put back into a place of at-ease, whether it's about the physical body, whether it's about the emotional health, whether it's about the mind and sanity itself that you're trying to hold on to. One unity principle worked completely until it's smooth. You can take that giant down. But don't do what I have done sometimes. Sometimes I found myself wanting to take the giant down so that I can brag about what Carly did. I don't know if you all know, but I almost went blind. I'm still going through some therapy with pills and eye drops, but I almost allowed myself to go completely and irrevocably blind in my left eye 2 months ago when I was visited by a virus that had visited me when I was in India. It came back with a vengeance. My face looked like Job. I had boils and bumps and knots all over my face. I would not let my brother Timothy's daughter see me. I would not let her see me for 12 or 13 days. I wouldn't let Karen, his wife, see me. I didn't want to horrify them. Tim was the only one who saw me, and Tim every day, and I could not see out of this eye. The virus was in this eye, such as it was in India, but having come back with a vengeance, it was horrible. And let me tell you what I did. Every time Timothy said, you got to let me take you to the emergency room, you got to let me take you to the doctor, every single time he said it, I went, I'm going to do this myself. Me and God are going to do this. And I laid there doing affirmations, and I am a Reiki master, and I did Reiki on my eye. And the third day I went, oh my God, I forgot about crystals. And I went and found my powerful vortex of quartz crystal, and I put that on my eye. Around the fourth day, I started putting pee in my eye. Like, oh yeah, you're in therapy. I've heard that it's sterile and that it fights bacteria. Yeah, that's what people used back in the slave days when they would get whipped. Somebody would just pee on their back to help the healing. Oh, yeah, I know that for a fact. And I'm doing my own thing. And every time Tim goes, let me take you to the doctor, I'm going to do this with God. I didn't really mean that. Because there ain't no more God in me than there is in a doctor, a certified eye doctor. Somebody who had gone to school, knew what he was doing, what she was doing, knew about medications, knew when you need steroids and when you need antibacteria, this or that or the other. I'm at home. I want to do this myself. Very different from David. Little David, when David confronted his giant, he didn't say, I come in here in the name of myself. I might look like a little kid that ain't never been out of the country. I may look like somebody that the king should never have trusted. But check this out, dude. I'm here to bring you down. He didn't do that. That's what I did. Not him. He said, I don't come to you in my own authority or under the influence of my own power. I come in the name of the God of Israel. And when I take you down, it will have been God who took you down. All for the glory of Israel and for the glory of God. When we are being true to our own self, we are living in such a way that we are doing everything for the glory of God. And living in a way that you're doing everything for the glory of God can become a magnificent obsession. The book, the movie, Magnificent Obsession, serve sneaky like. Give without. Make sure that when you sing your song, when you dance your dance, when you preach your sermon, when you do whatever you do, when you come and volunteer and when you serve, make sure that you're not doing it so that the world can stand up around you and go, you are awesome. Make sure you're doing it for the glory of God. When you go to put gas in your car, know that that's not really what God wants you to be doing. In the physical world, you need to go put gas in your car. But don't just go put gas in your car. Go to shine the light of God on whoever it is that is at that gas station, whoever it is that comes to pump your gas. When I go to the store to get some rice and some chicken and some beans, I'm not really going to get rice and chicken and beans. I'm going to shine the blazing light of God on whoever it is that's in that grocery store, whoever's cart needs me to move around it. And regardless of how long the line is or the fact that I'm in a rush and the person in front of me pulls out that many coupons, that I go, God has not sent me here to be impatient. God has not sent me here to be in a hurry. God has sent me here to set this world on fire. When I am being true to my own true self is the self that God created me to be, the self that is worthy of all my love, the self that needs to remember to love me with all of my heart, all of my soul, all of my mind, and all of my strength, or I will find myself trying to get that from you. And as I said the last time I was here, no matter how wonderful your sweetie pie is, no matter how much your boo loves you, your boo can't give you what you need. What you need is a feeling of love when you are naked and alone. What you need is a feeling of self-love that springs to life, even, as I said before, when you find that you have pooped next to the pad rather than on it. To remember that you are God's keeper. God will never forsake you, will never leave you. You must believe that. You must trust in that with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, and all of your strength. And you must, as our brother Lewis reminded us of at the beginning of the service, you must learn to discern when you are under the influence of the Holy Spirit, when you are under the influence of Christ's mind, when you are under the influence of God as opposed to when you are under the influence of your own ego. Let me tell you one thing. The doctors, when I finally went there 8 days later, told me that I had come 2 days close to being permanently blind in my left eye. And then they did some studies and looked at my right eye, and they asked the question, have you ever been told that you have glaucoma? And I went, you know what, man? I think somebody told me that when I was 19 or 20 or 21. I said I had glaucoma and I needed to come back and I needed to start some treatments. That either actually happened or I dreamed it happened. And I can't even remember which. He said, you can't remember whether it actually happened? I said, dude, when I was 19 and 20, I was lit. I was lit. If a doctor actually did tell me that, I want you to know I walked out of that place and I went, oh, glaucoma, good reason to smoke some dope. Heard that's good for it. I've been doing the right thing. At any rate, they did some more tests and they found out I do have glaucoma. It has been advancing all these years that I haven't thought anything about it. And then the two surgeons were in front of me and said, you are 64 if you're telling the truth when you wrote it on the form. If you're telling the truth, you're 64. I'm telling the truth, I'm 64. He said, listen, you could so easily be completely blind before you're 70. If he had said, you could be dead before you're 70, I would go, something in me would have gone, whoopee-dink. I'm not really into longevity. I ain't trying to live to be 90 or more years old. I'm just trying to be happy each day until the day I drop. That's all. But to be told you could be alive and blind, that had a different impact on me. It impacted me in a way that made me go, you are crazy if you don't get with whatever program he tells you to get on. You're absolutely crazy if you don't start getting on the good foot. So he told me I have to take these pills, go and told Timothy, can you drive him to another town where he can get this and that and the other and see another specialist, and then he'll tell you what medication. So I'm taking pills and I'm taking eye drops, two different kinds of eye drops on a schedule. I'm doing everything I can to retain my sight. It's like we must do what we must do to have what we want to have. We must know that we are it. Be who you want to be. Every day, choose to be the you that is the biggest idea you ever had of who you could be. Just decide to be it. To be it. And to go, that's my own self. My own self is higher than I've been manifesting. It's brighter than any star. My own self knows that I am completely innocent, knows that I am completely guiltless, knows that all things are possible with God. That's my own self. I must own my own self. But like I said earlier, first I must embrace this guy I think I am. To look at him in the mirror and go, you can be a handful. And I love you so much. Dude, you told everybody in church you were going to go home and you were going to work on the Christmas music all week so that when you came to choir rehearsal, you'd have everything smooth. And you didn't do nothing but watch some TV and chill out. I love you. In my house, we do this. If Sienna, Timothy and Karin's daughter, is in another room, minding her own business, I yell out, Sienna! Yeah, Baba? Is it awesome being awesome? Yeah, it's awesome being awesome. And then she waits a while because she doesn't want me to see when it's coming. So when I'm minding my own business, all of a sudden I'll hear, or there's a knock on the door. Excuse me, could I come in? It'll only take a second. Yeah. Baba, is it awesome being awesome? And I go, it's so awesome being awesome. So that's another assignment for you other than kissing the mirror. I want you to speak to yourself and the people around you. When you least expect it or they are, I would like my voice to come into your mind and you hear me calling you by your name, going, and if it's not by your name, you can hear me going, hey, Keeper. Or I could go, hey, Carrie Lee. Is it awesome being awesome? You answer.
Yes, it's awesome being awesome.
We are all so awesome. Your own self is awesome. To your own self, be true. God is in heaven. Heaven is in you. Holy is your name. God wants you to know you have nothing to fear, and there is nothing and no one to blame. You have been informed. Your captivity is over. You've been informed in truth. You're free. And so it is.
We are so blessed. Let those words and sweet music settle over your heart. We are so grateful for all that God is. Do you realize this morning that we are all filled with all that God is? Just like a wave in the mighty ocean, we hold all the divine salt and minerals and liquid of spirit at our deepest level. No matter what storms may occasionally stir the seas of our lives, no matter what the appearance of unease or strife, at our deepest level, God is here. Everywhere, in every moment. Even in the darkest corners of our minds, we know there is a center that is always peace and light filled, and always stable and unchanging. Our oasis of calm, where the unerring compass of spirit within us is always accessible in one moment of quiet prayer, when we choose to return to our deepest peace. As spiritual beings, it's easy to be distracted by our lively human experience, when the rush and roar of our busy lives is often so loud and crazy. It can sometimes shake us to our core and knock us off center. But in the very next heartbeat, with our very next breath, we can clear our heads and refocus on that light-filled heart. And once again, we are home. There is no outward condition so frightening, no argument so strong or voice so loud that can deafen the still small voice of God that loves and guides us. When our elder brother and teacher Jesus traveled in the boat with the disciples, a great storm arose, and in fear, the disciples woke Jesus from his rest, fearing they would all drown. And Jesus stood up and cried, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased and the waves were calm. "Why were you afraid?" Jesus asked. "Where is your faith? Where is your faith this morning?" We are here today to know that the light of Spirit will never be dimmed in our hearts. It is always there to see you through any challenge. Never hesitate to go within and drink from the deep well of Spirit that sustains you. In fear and trembling, or in triumph with rejoicing, rest assured that a loving God is here and all is well. And now, as we move into a few moments of silence, imagine that light of Spirit growing brighter in your consciousness as you relinquish any concerns in your heart this morning. Embrace the warmth and comfort as courage floods your heart. Peace, be still. Peace, be still. In the stillness of the bright heart of God in me, I am strengthened this morning. I take in a deep breath and feel my body whole and strong. I am restored in mind, body, and spirit, and filled with divine equilibrium. With joy, I am ready to move out into my day. And so it is. Amen.